Yes,
we actually have the bill. It's only, we're about ready to adjourn. The Senate has finally saw fit to send us the most important bill of the session. But then again. So we were working through some of Representative Clark's concerns, and I don't know, Judge Ellis and Chairman Myers, and Kathy Bogan, I assume you're going to be the heavy hitters today. So why don't the three of you come up, and as soon as Kelly gets back in the room, we'll go over it. For the information of Representative Miller, yesterday, we talked about several things. One thing we talked about was substantial and compelling evidence as the basis to deviate from the presumed sentence. Is it presumptuous sentence or presumed sentence?
Presumptive.
Presumptive.
Presumptuous.
Sorry. Presumptive sentence. I'm sure I'm not the first, nor will I be the last to make that mistake. And the standard remains substantial and compelling. We define substantial and compelling several ways. These should be extraordinary cases. They should be uncommon cases. They should not be not more than 10% of the cases. When this finding is made, there would have to be facts to base the finding upon. As an example, the victim was particularly vulnerable. Those facts would have to be in the record. And the determination of the judge would have to be consistent with the purposes of the act, which is punishment and public safety. And we also received a strong missive from Judge Joseph regarding this fact. This does not in any way, shape, or form imply a de novo review of sentences. Proof of criminal history remains the burden of the prosecutor. We did have an extensive discussion about emergency leave. There's provisions in the bill for someone who's terminally ill. However, there does need to be added provisions regarding some emergency leave, and the two examples we used were pregnancy and mother's funerals. I suppose father's funerals would qualify too, at least we get crosswise. Good time provisions were also discussed yesterday on page 27. The good time remains at a possible 20% off that. Now, Representative Clark, you were kind of being our discussion leader yesterday, and we were going where you wanted us to go. So where would you like us to go next? I do believe the members have their amendments. Clark Callori and Burton's kind of their answer to Wagner's ring cycle in the form of amendments. Representative Clark.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Early this morning. We stopped last night on the question of the authority that the board has to make interim adjustments to the guidelines, and I wanted particularly Representative Baum, Representative Miller to hear the testimony about that, so maybe we could pick up there, and I could just ask Hardy or Bob or the judge what the bill does in terms of giving the board interim adjustment if capacity projections aren't met. How much authority does the board have? What does the bill do in those regards, if anything?
Mr. Chair, Hardy Myers, Council Chairman. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the bill assigns the board authority to make guidelines adjustments when population, or to maintain consistency between population and effective capacity. And I think the invited interpretation by the legislature of effective capacity is the capacity as it's been projected throughout all the work of the council, which takes into account that 3% margin for special purpose beds, month-to-month population fluctuations, and so on. I might add, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, that this provision, this approach to the question of adjustment of sanction policies is an outgrowth, I think, of a couple of factors. One is, as the bill is now pending, you're going to eliminate temporary leave totally within 1 year from November 1. We're going to begin phasing it out November 1, and it ceases to exist for any offender November 1, 1990. So the major device that the legislature's previously accorded the system to flex, so to speak, is going to be eliminated, at least if that provision stays in the bill. Secondly, and maybe Judge Ellis would want to comment on this also, by putting in a dispositional line to control the choice between probation and imprisonment, you are eliminating the discretion of sentencing judges to take into account, at least explicitly take into account, the situation in the institutions as to population. Under these guidelines, if a judge were to take an offender with a presumptive imprisonment sentence and choose probation and base that on the fact that that judge thought there wasn't room in the institutions, that's an illegal sentence. And then I guess a final factor leading to this provision, Representative Clark, is that for the first 2 years or more, we're going to be at the highest point of uncertainty about projections because you're going to have this new system and you're phasing out the old system. You've got the two working together. So, but the first two factors, especially the elimination of temporary leave, is really the genesis of this proposal.
Representative Clark.
What happens if, I guess I need to get some sense for how far the sentences that are in the grid, what kind of reductions happen to those sentences if, for whatever reason, beds don't come online the way we anticipate? Is there some process by which the board or the council would be in dialogue with interim judiciary, e-board, somebody, anybody?
Speaking of which, I'm hoping 2713 Conference Committee can meet again today.
Right. Who do you talk to about that during the interim? Is the question for me.
Chairman Representative Clark, I think you've named the two bodies that I would expect to be most likely involved in terms of either dialoguing about the potential choices that the board might make or trying to find a political or budgetary solution that would avoid the need to make any adjustments to sanction policies. Certainly, I think it goes without saying that the board and the council would be very desirous of avoiding any change if absolutely possible. And I'm confident would want the legislature to have every opportunity to find a political solution before this step had to be taken.
Representative Clark, next question.
Mr. Chair, that plus what we covered yesterday are the kind of the major areas that I want to talk about in 1073 before we started. Before we started working with amendments.
Now, does everybody have amendments? They're 1073-B, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26.
Those are the amendments?
Those are the amendments.
And
Representative Clark, I guess the best way is just to... unless you want to wait for Representative Calori,
my understanding is that he's going to be held up for a bit, and
in revenue, isn't he?
Revenue. Yeah. Well, he's
Mr. Chair, what I'd like to do, if it would not be presumptuous, would be to kind of briefly outline for the committee members what each of these amendments does, and then one by one go through them and get the reaction of the witnesses to these. And then when we get...
Do gentlemen have the amendments?
Yes.
Okay.
And then when we get done with that, find out what the committee's pleasure is in terms of some of them being adopted. The B-18 amendments were intended to reverse the presumption by which sentencing guidelines go into effect. The 87 legislation said that felony sentencing guidelines go into effect automatically unless amended or repealed by the legislature. The intent of the B-18 amendments is to change that presumption and say that the guidelines and amendments shall not become effective unless affirmatively approved by the next legislative assembly. And again, that is an attempt to force the kind of legislative overview and dialogue that I think, in my view, 87 legislation did not exactly force.
Now, let me ask you, Representative Clark, would this be retroactive? This wouldn't cover these sentencing guidelines.
No, although there's another amendment on the following page to Section 92 of the bill, which attempts to do that. Section 5 on page 2, lines 3 through 5, are an attempt to put a provision in 1073 that is an affirmative approval of the guidelines.
Although I believe that's in the present bill.
That was added in the Senate version, so we could probably leave out page 2 of the B-18 amendments. Because, Mr. Myers, where is that in...
Section
87.
Yeah, 87 on page 36.
Where was that section for the interim adjustment? 87.
Oh,
interim authority.
It's 89, subsection 3.
Thank you. Section 87 was.
Okay. All right. Let me go through the rest of them quickly, just to outline them. The Dash B 19 amendments are the ones raising eyebrows, I suppose. The 87 legislation required the board to tell the legislature where it thought the guidelines were inappropriately limited by capacity. The board did that in a report from about a month ago, and the B-19 amendments take the information given to us by the board and basically hands it back to the board and says, go strengthen the guidelines in those three areas. And you should all have copies of that report. If you don't, you need it, because it's a vital document to understanding where we are in sentencing guidelines. And it is called Recommendations Regarding Additional Correctional Resources. It's on Oregon Criminal Justice Council letterhead, May 19. If you don't have that, you need that. All the B-19 amendments do is take the board at its word and say, we would like you to go back and strengthen the guidelines in those three areas: crimes involving delivery, manufacturing, cultivation of marijuana, crimes involving delivery, manufacture, cultivation of all controlled substances, and violent crimes against persons. And I'm going to want to get the feedback from the panel on capacity impact of those amendments, because I think they're probably pretty substantial. From there on out, the B-20 through the B-26 amendments are specific changes to the guidelines rules. Places where there were, during the course of the rules being changed and amended, where there was some discussion about going one direction, the board chose to go a different direction, and in reviewing those, it seemed to me to be more appropriate to do something a little bit different. And so the 87 legislation says if you're going to amend the guidelines, you must do it by statute, which is a little bit odd because you're amending administrative rules by statute. But that's what the 87 legislation says, and so that's what the B-20 through the B-26 amendments do. B-20 has to do with attempts and solicitations. B-21 has to do with how you measure the criminal history scale. B-22 has to do with how you prove the criminal history scale.
Whoa. Okay. 20, what did it do with attempts and solicitations?
Well, The decision made by the board was that attempted crimes would be ranked on the crime seriousness scale two categories below the completed crime. in the Oregon State Bar report regarding proposed changes to the to the rules, suggested that one crime category below the appropriate category for a completed offense might be more appropriate, and that seems to me to be appropriate, more appropriate as well. So rather than two, an attempt falling two crime categories below the attempt, B-20 just says that it will be one category below the attempt, and below the completed crime. B-21 is quite simple. Has to do with when you measure the offender's criminal history. Instead of measuring the criminal history at the time when the current offense was committed, this one says we're going to measure it from the time the current offense, the current offender was is sentenced. So you've got a time gap there where theoretically the offender could have been tried and convicted for another offense, even while waiting trial on the present offense. It's just a way, it's just an attempt to get a little more accurate picture of what this offender's actual criminal history is by not precluding the, I don't know, 60-day, 90-day, 120-day window before sentencing. B-22 has to do with proof of criminal history. And frankly, I'm not sure that the B-22 amendments do exactly what I was trying to do. And I want to talk to the panel about that. So maybe we can come back to that one.
A constitutional problem on 22 too.
Well, that's a good point, and that's an issue for that we need to discuss. The B-23 amendments. Again, most of what these are were taken from the Oregon State Bar's recommendations to the board. That's where I picked up most of this in terms of the dialogue. B-23 takes terms of post-prison supervision, and instead of 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years, says that for all crime categories 1 through 10, it'll be 3 years.
Do you have a fiscal impact on that?
Nope. Okay. There will be, though. B-24 has to do with duration of probation. And this one, I think, seems to me, as I've listened to all the testimony as we've gone through these things, that one of the primary benefits of sentencing guidelines is that it makes probation real, and a violation of probation becomes real and has real consequences. And so this B-24 amendment increases the terms of probation. B-25 has to do with the departure factors, and it increases the number of times when, quote, persistent involvement in similar offenses, end quote, may be considered as an aggravating offense. And that you can find that on page 2, lines 13 through 16. B-26. Revocation sanctions. Where probation has been violated, B-26 amendments take the sentence that person will be given and make it one category above what the person would have otherwise been given. In other words, first time around, if I'd have been given it just moves it so that there is an additional there's an additional sanction for violation of probation beyond the original crime.
Okay, any comments from the initial questions from the panel members before we go to Representative Baum?
I thought these 26. Now, does this mean that a judge can sentence a person to a 3 years in jail, a prison under the guidelines, some kind of probation is involved, and they violate the probation, and there's an enhanced penalty for violating the probation?
Seems to be what it says. We misinterpreted that?
Yes.
What about their original revocation?
The Not sure what you're asking.
Well, they were already to be revoked on the prior crime. There's already one penalty been imposed.
You can't impose county jail time for violation of probation without reaching the original sentence. But
yeah.
Are we talking about extending the original sentence another 6 months in prison for?
Talking about extending the second sentence.
The sentence upon revocation. Can you help out, Bob?
Well, under the rules, I believe you would get up to 90 days in jail, which under the rules you could almost go up to 180 if there's enough space and whatnot. Then, as I understand the proposed amendment, it would say that if it was a departure from a presumptive prison term to a probationary sentence, and the offender subsequently is revoked, then in calculating what the sanction for the revocation, the judge would go to the original grid block, move up one crime category to the next grid block above it, and that would give him or her the presumptive sentence that he could impose as a sanction. Does that clarify it?
So it could be greater than the original sanction imposed when they put him on probation but suspended the execution of sentence.
There's no suspension of sentence in the guidelines system. It's a sanction for a violation of a revocation sentence.
I think if I'm hearing him correctly, it's the only time this comes up is when the judge departed from a sentence which would have been prison. The judge departed and gave probation. Actually found mitigating circumstances and said, instead of sending you to prison, I'm going to put you on probation.
I'm telling you that it might have problems with that if it goes back to be challenged by to say that you've just sentenced me twice.
Maybe.
The same crime, constitutionally. We can't do that now. You know, you can't revoke a guy's probation and then execute a greater sentence than you give him on the first day he was sentenced and put on probation.
But that procedure is eliminated by the guidelines. There
right,
would be no more fixing of a sentence and suspending execution.
Is Judge or Mr. Myers, is the concern that Representative Baum raising as to the existing practice, is that a constitutional problem that is raised by the B-26 amendments?
There is a limitation now, but I think it's case law that there's two different ways of putting people, at least two ways under present law of putting people on probation. One is to suspend the imposition of sentence for a period of time and place a person on probation, usually for the same period of time. And the other is to fix a sentence and then suspend execution or carrying out of the sentence for a period of time and put the person on probation for that period of time. And in that latter category, there is case law that the judge, if you revoke the probation, the only thing you can do is execute that earlier fixed sentence. You can't change it up or down.
Yeah, that's the
But that means of putting people on probation is eliminated by guidelines. The concept of suspending execution of a sentence is eliminated. You just place them on probation, and then when you revoke them, you can impose a prison sentence.
Unless you find those mitigating factors that drop you down to a lesser.
Right. And the way I read this was just that if the presumptive sentence was 18 months and the judge found reason for departure and placed the person on probation, then when they come back, if they're revoked, the presumptive sentence is not 18 months. You go up one line on the grid and it's whatever's in that box, which might be 22 months or 24.
That's a real analogous situation to setting the getting them a sentence and then suspend execution upon successful completion of probation, and they violate, and then you execute sentence on them. And now we're going to do the same thing, and they violate, not the same thing, but potentially there's where they should go. They don't go because of mitigating factors. Now we say, well, instead of going where you would have done originally, we're going to enhance it.
It's evidently an enhanced penalty for failing on probation.
Always give it a whirl.
Well, I'm trying to think of what the problem would be. I suppose the problem would be, it's not a double jeopardy. Well,
no, I didn't think there was a legal problem. But
just give it a whirl.
But why would we want to do that?
Why
just an enhanced penalty for failing probation?
Yeah. There's a separate sanction for violating the probation apart from the original crime. That's the... As I hear... And I'm interested, we might as well start here with feedback and then work our way back through the... Mr. Vice Chair, work our way back through the amendments. As I understand... the criminal justice world, and I don't, my practice is not in that area, and I don't have much experience in that area, but none of it works unless you've got an effective probation system going. And that's one of the major breakdowns in our system is that probation doesn't mean anything. And it seems to me that if you've got, if this person knows that not only will he or she get 15 months for the crime, but an additional something for violation of probation in and of itself, it just seems to me to heighten the incentive to work with the probation system. Now, I realize that much of what we're doing is going to be very, very difficult to do with existing community corrections resources and people out there, the probation workers, the caseworkers. But that, I've got to at least make that a separate question from the policy. So any other reaction from you, Judge, or Hardy, or anybody on this?
My reaction is just that, bearing in mind the limited space, there might be some satisfaction in punishing the person because, you know, we gave you an opportunity and you blew it. But bearing in mind that we're dealing with this limited and expensive resource, my preference would be to use it for people who, because of their crime, ought to be confined, not just because they wouldn't report to their probation officer or flunk their urinalysis for alcohol or drugs or something of that sort, which is the kind of things that occasionally result in probation revocation. It doesn't seem to me to fit as logically on this just deserts. The whole idea of the sentencing guidelines is just deserts. That is, that for this conduct with this record, you deserve and will receive this punishment. And here we're saying, but if you fail on probation, you get an additional. The difference, it seems to me, the threat of the 18 months in the example I gave won't control the person's behavior on probation, I'm kind of dubious whether an additional 4 or 5 months is going to do it, or whatever the difference in going up one level would result in the sentence. My own reaction was I'd a little rather spend those beds on somebody who's there because of the crime they committed and their prior record rather than just that they were a failure on probation.
The points I would like to make is that if we do that, we'd like to know what the bed space consequences would be if we had that kind of sanction.
Representative Baum, Mr. Chair, one of the things that I've asked Kathleen Bogan and Hardy to do is to prepare a bed impact statement for us on almost all of these amendments. And so what I'd like to do, and I think that they're prepared to respond to questions about what each one of these would take, cost in terms of capacity. But before we get into that, I want to come back to, and I suppose now is as time good a time as any to engage in dialogue about the B-19 amendments.
Back to our old friend marijuana.
Well,
friend, we don't know where he's at, but we know he's a friend.
B-19. Yeah. And I guess I'll direct this question to Mr. Myers. The recommendations regarding additional correctional resources that the council made to the legislature a month ago. The guidelines that the board brought to us, without even us touching them, are going to cause a 1,200-bed shortfall in capacity between now and 10 years from now. That's what this report says.
Yes.
Roughly 1,200 beds. Okay, so nothing that we can do here will break that line. We're not the ones breaking new ground, so to speak, regardless of what we do, unless we could direct you to go back and take away 1,200 beds from your guidelines so that you fall within projected capacity. But you've already told us, like you were required to do by the 87 legislation, that what you think are appropriate sentencing guidelines are going to cause a 1,200-bed shortfall. Then you've also said on pages 4, 5, and 6 of this report that there are three areas that the council felt that the capacity projections inappropriately limited the guidelines. And those three areas were sanctions for delivery, manufacturing, and cultivation of controlled substances, imprisonment as a sanction for post-prison supervision violations, and sanctions for violent crimes against persons. Maybe you could walk us through each one of those areas from highest priority to lowest priority and tell us where and how you think the guidelines are inappropriately limited by capacity. That makes sense.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, the inappropriate limitations as they pertain to controlled substances in effect amount to a judgment that the sanctions for the offenses that are proposed to be changed are lower than than is desirable. They're inappropriately low because of resource limitations. The judgment about use of prison for sanctioning post-prison supervision violations, what would now be parole, is a judgment that 6 months as a flat across the board's limitation is inappropriately low and should be increased in some fashion. We recommend it, as I think your proposal does, a scaling according to the duration of supervision.
Myers, let me stop you there. Does everybody have in front of them this report? It's going to make a whole lot more sense if you're following along. Okay, sorry.
Summary. And then the final area, again, amounts to a judgment that the pending or the guideline sanction.
Reports, well, there's a heavy trend of crime. We have to reduce the guidelines in order to accommodate current space, or there's going to have to be further space if you want to even maintain the guidelines that are in place right now. That's the way it goes. Now, do the politicians in the legislature in any given session react to that by passing legislation to build prison space or to reduce the guidelines, or do they just not act? And if they don't act, through that inaction, they have created prison overcrowding problems. And at any given time,
the amendment, that would be the situation, because the legislature would have to affirmatively.
So in that respect, I guess what you're saying is, in terms of this kind of allocation of resource, let the reality be presented to the legislature, and that gives them an opportunity to act. But absent action, there's going to have to be some intelligent way of dealing with the overpopulation that's going to result, and rather than simply opening the front doors and saying whoever's the fastest to run out gets out the front door, and after 100 of you have run out, we'll close the doors again.
Well, I'll tell you who will end up running it, though, at that time. Will be the federal court will end up running the prison.
I don't know why I don't have those, because I have.
If it takes an affirmative vote of the legislature to reduce the guidelines in order to control population, or an affirmative vote of the legislature in order to build more beds, which takes a long time and probably won't be any money, you'll get yourself in a situation where there is no money to build further, and there is no political will to reduce the guidelines. That will happen. And at that time, when you have intolerable overcrowding, the federal court will take over your prison.
But Mr. Chair, I guess the point I would want to make is that before Colori, Clark, and Burton ever had any amendments drafted, before we ever did that, the council themselves has told us that scenario is down the horizon, is down the road. Because the guidelines that they have brought us are going to cause a capacity shortfall.
And basically, and this is no criticism of the council, it's going to sound like it, the council itself, and they're going to disagree with me, the council itself couldn't resist temptation not to stay within population. You see, there's always that temptation to get a little bit tougher, and it is a temptation. And that's, I appreciate what they've done, and I know the people on the council, and I know the personalities, and I know what their thinking was, and I was in the council. But they bring us this recommendation.
Go ahead. With all due respect, I disagree. I think what they said was, if we move the disposition grid sentences back any further, they will not be appropriate sentences for these crimes. We can't in good conscience recommend this sentence for this crime.
Well, yeah, you're putting it in nice words. You're saying appropriate sentence for crime.
Chairman?
Yeah. Representative Mann.
Back to the original function of this process, you've simply told us, look, we tried to match reality in terms of allocation of resources with desirability in terms of sanctions. Here's the best we can do given the proposed amount of prison space available. But even on this track, but what you're giving us is good for 2 years. It's not bad for human planning, and our budgets don't even last that long. But a couple of years from now, even with what's being proposed to be put online, we're going to start running behind again. We should have that warning so we know that next legislative session, there's nobody saying, gee, you should have warned us. You should have told us that we weren't on track. We all know, and we can tell the Senate, and they'll hear about it next election anyway, that they had better
start. Half of them will hear about it
next election, that they better be realistic about what the problem is right now. But that's another speech for another time. In terms of this bill, I don't know how much more we can expect of human beings in terms of planning for the future.
Chairman,
I just want to say one thing. I hope politically, I believe politically in a situation where you cannot touch these guidelines, whatever eventually we approve, in terms of bringing them down because of limited resources, at least for a biennium, this biennium. I really mean that. And that's why I'm getting so self-serving and want to know, no longer do I want to know just how many more beds is it going to cost in terms of what we do. I want to know the impact on this metropolitan area, since this is the area that's going to get hit the hardest in terms of the spillage. I mean that, Mr. Representative Mason. I believe that. And I don't think you can touch these guidelines, that is, adjust them so there are less sentences for at least this next biennium in view of the incredible discussion that's going on here and this written document in which you make these statements that they're inappropriate, et cetera, et cetera. So I wish someone would tell me now the impact on Salem Kaiser, and no longer can you say that you talk about a clause in here, and I know it's in here, Hardy's saying you can adjust them, which means you're adjusting them downward. I don't think you can touch that clause for biennium politically. I really mean it. So it's going to be interesting. Because those 500 beds, forget the 500 beds, Hardy. They're not out there. You know that for the next two to 3 years. I'm telling you, it's not out there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Courtney, I certainly agree with you that every possible effort should be made to avoid any kind of adjustments. And if adjustments are made, I'm going to assure you there's going to be every effort to make them as marginal and as small as possible. One factor in helping to assure, however, or minimize the prospect of some kind of adjustment, I think, is a real hard-headed assessment of what, in fact, you think you can impose on the system in terms of capacity demands, especially during the first 2 years. And I think that's the crux of the issue that Representative Clark's amendments raise. I don't think it's the substance of them. I think it would be very desirable for this session to go on record as stating where it wants priority attention to be given with respect to future guidelines changes, in the sense that it's saying, here are the new policies or changing policies in the future that we're going to try to provide new resources to make possible.
But Mr. Myers and Representative Clark, so what? I mean, so what? So the legislature goes on record saying we need more prison space. That's an empty promise. That's nonsense. So what?
Well, I mean, anybody can do that.
It comes right back to the whole question about the guidelines. And are they going to be... I've said this so many times that I have to apologize for saying it again, but when I first looked at the guidelines, I couldn't figure out, frankly, whether they were a clever way to avoid admitting that we've got a prison shortage in the state, an excuse for not building prisons, or whether they were simply a very good management tool for filling up whatever beds the legislature decides to build. And I've come to the conclusion that I think they are a very good management tool for filling up whatever beds the legislature decides to build. But that's only after you get past a threshold level where the guidelines provide an appropriate sanction for a given crime. And I think the council has said to us that with existing capacity, they don't. You got to get past that threshold before you can even begin to talk about how far up, how many prisons you want to build. And I don't believe you want to build prisons more and more. I don't think we want 3,000 bed facilities out there. California has shown us that you can't just build your way out of a crime wave.
There is,
but you've got to have a minimum level that will make the system work, and you got to have probation, you got to have post prison supervision, you got to have all of those things to make the system work.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond to your question for just a moment, the so what question you asked.
Well, my so what in the sense that I'm just so tired of hearing this nonsense. Where everybody wants more prisons and no one wants to pay for them.
And that's my so what.
Mr. Chairman, I think...
Well, there's some of us that will pay for
them. No, well, there are and there aren't, because you got to remember that you guys are running off funny money. You're running off lottery money. You are running off lottery money. And I'll tell you that if this session had to pay for this out of our hide instead of lottery money, it'd be a little bit different.
And I have, you know, and back when Representative Myers was here, we tried to pay for it out of bonding, and the people turned it down cold three times. So they didn't want to pay for it. And if it wasn't for the fact we had this funny money around, we probably wouldn't want to pay for it either. If the vote on the floor had to be take $100 million per prison out of basic school support, you would not vote for it. Take $100 million per prison out of higher ed, you would not vote
Chair,
for it.
Chair, don't assume that.
Well, I mean, I just know how
votes are cast. We've got a difference
in
philosophy here, Mr. Chair.
What?
We've got a difference in philosophy here because I think, I mean, we don't need to get too esoteric here, but if you got a government that can't even provide for its citizens' safety, there's not a whole lot else that matters. That's the basic philosophical breakdown there, is that unless you can provide for basic safety, your government loses all credibility in all areas, it seems to me.
We may return to walled cities, Mr. Chairman. Those
Chairman,
who are inside the walls and those who are outside the walls.
I think that the way I'd respond to your so what question is this way. I think that all of these different problems and unknowns about the budget and revenue and what's possible and what will be decided politically are going to be there regardless of whether you have a control structure. But what this proposal gives you is the ability to say, in terms of pursuing new resources, what we want them for in fairly specific terms. Both the 1,200 beds initially, in terms of the existing guidelines, and then new resources beyond that. But whether you get them is, who knows at this point. And I think to come back to, I think the two issues that Representative Clark's proposal raises are, one, are these the priorities this session, if it wants to go on record for any, priorities for changes that it wants to emphasize, it wants to endorse, or are there others? Though I think it would be good to have priorities on record. If there can be agreement reached on them. And then secondly, when do they become effective? Are you going to mandate they go into force now or at some other date? And we can, maybe that, at some point you want to deal with some impact analysis.
Well, I definitely do.
Yeah, we're running out of time. What I would like to do, Representative Courtney and Representative Clark are meeting with corrections at 12, it's conference committee in 2713 at 12. Why don't we adjourn until... wishful thinking on my part, till 12:30. It shouldn't take you more than half an hour to clean up 2713, right?
It would only take the House 3 minutes, Mr. Chairman. The question is how long would it take?
Come back with
side?
Your shield or on it, Representative Courtney.
No, it's more difficult than that.
I'm being snide.
And why don't we come back at 12:30 and try to work on this a little bit more and then start to go through the amendments. And we're going to adjourn for about 5 minutes and then go into full committee. Okay? Thank you very much. I'm sure you enjoyed the philosophy. We'll be back in about 5 minutes with the full committee. What?
Okay, someday we'll be in charge of this.